Welcome to another NABBW teleseminar on a topic of huge interest to boomer women and their families, making midlife changes. This is a topic I've personally dealt with, and I'm sure all of you have as well. The question is, how well do we do with them? Hello, my name is Ann Holmes. I'm your moderator and the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, an organization dedicated to educating and empowering women at midlife. This call, like all of those we do every month, is one of the ways we serve our membership. In a moment, I will introduce our guest expert, Tracy Barnes Priestley, so that we can start our discussion. But before we launch into our topic, let me say a few words about how this call will proceed. For the next 45 minutes or so, the phone lines will be muted, and Tracy and I will be discussing tonight's topic. Then I will open the lines for questions from our listening audience. If you have a question before the lines are open, use the box on your computer screen to type in the question into the box. I'll be able to see that, and then I'll pass it on to Tracy when the time is appropriate. All right, moving forward. Our guest tonight, Tracy Barnes Priestley, has recently authored her first novel, Duck Pond Epiphany. This book is available in bookstores as well as online via Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. For more information about it, you can go to Tracy's website, www.thesecondhalfonline.com. I love that name, The Second Half Online. Now, let me tell you just a little bit about Tracy. Tracy Barnes Priestley holds a master's degree in counseling psychology and spent many years as a therapist before moving into the field of personal coaching. An award-winning syndicated columnist for 14 years, her column was called Juggling Jobs and Kids, Tracy currently writes and blogs about issues she and countless others face in the second half of life. Married for 35 years and the mother of three, Tracy lives among the redwoods of Northern California with her recently retired husband and their loyal mutt, Bella Von Doodle. And I have no idea how you came up with that name, but it's a great name. There must be a story to it.
There
anyway,
is.
We're delighted that those of you who are listening have joined us for this free call, and welcome Tracy Barnes Priestley.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about being here.
Oh, we're delighted to have you, Tracy. I am fascinated by the fact that you have the credentials of the coaching and the counseling before that, and I'm thinking that you've turned to writing a novel because sometimes it's easier to get your point across by telling people a story than by having them think that you're officially teaching them. Is that what was behind the concept of you going to a novel, or did you just have this yen to write a novel?
Well, that's a really interesting observation on your part. Thanks for that. I think I came to fiction for a variety of reasons. I started my first column, the syndicated column, years ago, probably in the 90s, and I've always had a column for about 25 years, and that's a Q&A format. So I get a lot of emails and letters and from all over the country, and I have had a strong educational bent. I'm just really practical and proactive, and I think that education is so powerful. But when it came to fiction, that was like my private little. I never thought of myself as a writer. I was a journalist. Mm-hmm. I'm not a writer. I'm a journalist,
right.
And I always was intrigued by. I thought, wouldn't it be great fun? Just fun to write mm-hmm. a book for women in the middle part of their lives where, yes, they could learn something, but they could learn something in a way that was not pedantic or not preachy, and maybe they'd laugh and maybe they'd cry. So it was selfish in terms of my own joy and my own fulfillment, mm-hmm. and yet there was that educational component.
Well, I can certainly understand that because I've worked in my field for years. I worked in the advertising and marketing field, and mm-hmm. so I was a copywriter. So I wrote tons and tons and tons of stuff, but it was nonfiction. It was, promotional material and that sort of thing. But I've had this desire in the back of my brain that someday I'm going to really have fun. I'm going to let loose and write a novel, but I've never made the time to figure out what that novel is going to be about. So I'm glad to meet someone who did it.
It was so much fun. I have to tell you, it was just really fun. I love the process of it. And then, initially, I had to kind of take out the message that I'm writing a book. I told a friend of mine, I said, it's kind of like some people take up bowling in midlife or learn how to knit. I just wanted to do this, never really expecting that I would actually try to find an agent and have it published. But lo and behold, here we are. And so it has a nice happy ending all the way around.
Excellent. Well, let's talk a little bit about your novel. It's called Duck Pond Epiphany, and I love the concept of being an epiphany, but I'd love it if you would give us a synopsis.
Well, thank you. It really is the story of Lee McPherson, who's 53, and she, one of the things I wrote is that she's lived her life coloring inside the lines. She's really done, she's kind of been the quintessential working mother of four. She's married to a faculty member at a small university, and her passion has always been art, so she has a little gallery, Mad Dog Gallery. But her last child has just gone off to college, and Lee finds herself a little overwhelmed by this evolution, but she's kind of exhilarated because she really has an opportunity here. So I think what follows is that her estranged husband, Brian, he knows what he wants, and he wants to get back with Lee, but she's not sure she's really having it. So we kind of follow them through their journey, and then I threw in Barb Yakamura, who is Lee's best friend for more than 20 years, and she's brilliant and irreverent and a little bawdy and sort of just the opposite of Lee. But
I
they
love
found
her.
Oh yeah. Thank you. But they really get so much. They complement each other. They get so much from each other. And I honestly just really wanted to write a story about thoughtful, aware people who were accountable and kind of ready to look at some of the hard stuff in such a way that they could change their lives. And I think they did in my book.
I would say so. Well, I don't want to give it away, but I would say it was a very satisfying novel, and Barb is just as important to the story as are Lee and Brian. So
yeah, thank you. Yeah, she fleshes it out.
That's right. Now, the book begins with the sentence, or the couple of sentences, "There are moments that forever change our lives. I just didn't realize this would be one of them." So would you tell us a little bit about how these lines set the tone for the different events that take place throughout the novel?
Well, I know in my own life, let me think of an example. Well, for example, I was as a grad student, I was on work study as a secretary in the department, and one day this just really devilishly handsome man walked into my office looking for a professor. And I was, you know, I was 23, and I went back to work, but I thought, oh my, isn't he a cutie? Well, you know, 38 years later, I still think he's pretty cute.
Good.
So there's a moment. It totally changed my life. Another example. Oh, my family and I the kids were little. We were all in the car going to go camping, and the phone rings. And this was the day before, days before answering machines. I ran back into the house. It was this wonderful man, an editor from Chicago, who was offering to pick up my local column and put it into national syndication. You know, my life changed on a dime. Then, of course, there's sadness. There are moments where, you know, it's just that I really wanted to recognize that each one of us has our own moments. And we don't have crystal balls. We don't know where they will lead us. But it's kind of that sense of life is a collection of moments, and pay attention to them and see what you can do with your own destiny, I suppose.
All right. Well, the way I read it, and I started to read it again the other day, and I think that I'm getting just as much out of it the second time through. So that really says something, because I will tell you that I have a kind of personal rule that I never read a book more than once.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm honored.
I don't know what it is about me and books, but I'm the same with movies. You know, once I've seen or absorbed something once, you know, I think, okay, moving on to something else.
Oh,
I picked the book up again, and I was just as caught up with it as I had been the first time.
Oh.
But let me ask, the book, as you said, the novel is about Lee and about Barb, her best friend, and then there's a whole host of other characters, and they're all in some way facing significant life changes. As you said earlier, for Lee it begins with her empty nest, and about that you wrote, I love this, "For the first time in 26 years, no one was going to run into the living room crying, walk through burping the alphabet, or throw him or herself at my feet, certain that they were about to die screaming, I'm starving."
Been there, done that, right?
Right, yes. So Lee alternates between exhilaration and being terrified by our new circumstances. And I guess I'd like to talk about, what is it about this situation that has her so conflicted?
Well, I think for women who have chosen to have children, and many have not, I love it that we have a choice. But I think that for those of us who have watched our children fly the nest one by one, I launched three, my husband and I launched three, there is kind of that moment, and for Lee, I think it's this quintessential moment that all those years of sort of prescribed routine and responsibility, I mean, there's a freedom that comes with that that's just kind of exciting. And yet there's a sadness. There's a genuine loss. There's a that you're not going to be doing, and Lee really liked parenting, and she's not going to be doing that anymore. So this conflict has her sort of stalled momentarily because she doesn't really know how to move. She's kind of swirling about in her own her own little farmhouse going, now what do I do? And I think that as a therapist and life coach, I've worked with so many women who, through this process, transitioning, they've identified themselves as wife and mother for so many years and perhaps a professional, but without that big chunk, they really, it sounds a little cliche, but the question of, well, who am I? You know, what do I do now?
Oh, I know. For me, and I really worked hard to raise responsible kids. As soon as mine could drive, I made each of them learn how to do the grocery shopping. They were so mad at me about learning how to do the grocery shopping until they got to college and found out that they were the only one that knew how to do grocery shopping. But I remember sending my my husband and I took my daughter off to college, and she was so excited about it. And we got up and we looked at her dorm room, and and you know, we hadn't bought anything in advance because we wanted to see how big the room was and everything.
Yeah.
And so then I had this vision that I'm going to take her out and we're going to go shopping, because she went to UW-Madison, which was my hometown. So I thought, oh, this will be so fun. We'll find, you know, we'll go to places that I know, and we'll you know, go down State Street, which is, you know, pretty famous in, UW-Madison, and we'll pick up the perfect stuff for her room. And no, because I raised this darn independent daughter, you know, she says, okay, goodbye. And I had to go back to the car and cry.
Isn't that the way it is? I think, again, it's such a rite of passage, and you really want them to take off and find their way and be confident, and yet the reality is, oh, you still remember them when they were these little babies. And yeah,
right.
It's a difficult time. It's a difficult time for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely one of the things that I thought that you did such a great job exploring in the novel, was how difficult change can be. And and maybe this would be a good time for us to have you expand a little bit more on that.
Well, I think, you know, admittedly, some people thrive on change. I think they're, frankly, in the minority. I mean, they're kind of the adrenaline junkies of the world, but they are out there. They are represented in the population. But by and large, I think most of us are kinds of creatures of habit. We like security, a certain amount of routine. And change, by its very nature, is risk. It's letting go of something that was and then trying to figure out what it's going to be. And that risk can be the fear of failure, the fear of judgment or embarrassment. And I have sadly seen so many people, because the fear is so great, I have seen people stay in bad marriages I always wanted to be a chef, but I was too afraid to go to cooking school, or too afraid. And I think that it you have to go backwards to kind of figure out what that's about. But what I've learned over the years is at the bottom of all of that is that individual's fear, and figuring out what that fear is really the first step to making change happen.
Figuring out and then facing it and then dealing, taking action against it, I guess was.
Absolutely. Because most of us, you know, growing up, there's certain dynamics in a family, you know, and certain ways that we do things and certain things that we don't do, and certain expectations, whether they're spoken or unspoken. And by the time you're on your own, and then society has another set of expectations on how we're all supposed to be. I think a very good example, and in my family with our three kids, our two daughters were these just, school was their thing. You know, they were, our oldest daughter now has ended up with two master's degrees from Berkeley, and our other has a master's from BU, Boston University. They love school. That's where they, and then in the middle was this creative, bright, wonderful boy who could hardly sit in a chair for longer than 10 seconds. I mean, he was just wired so differently. And I saw, and when he got to be getting ready to graduate, my husband and I said, "What do you want to do?" He said, "Well, I don't want to go to college." And we said, "That's fine, but you got to support yourself, and you got to do this, and you got to do that." And he went on to follow his path. He eventually graduated from college. But what I saw people saying to him was, "What? Your parents are educators. You're not going to college." I mean, there was this judgment about what he should do and how he should proceed with his life's plan, because that's what you do. You go to college. And it was really curious to me that I think that says so much about the other people, that they were afraid of seeing somebody doing something outside the lines, you know, outside the prescribed way. And we supported him and say, take the risk, you know, take it. Just go for it. And the end of that story now is he's 31 years old. He's got his own production company. He's worked with, you know, the likes of Madonna, and he's had films in Montreal Film Festival. He followed his passion.
But, excellent.
Yeah. Had he or had we not supported him and raised him to sort of believe in himself, he probably would have dropped out of college the first year and been miserable. a waste of money, a waste of time, you know. So there's a lot of things to consider when making change.
Oh, I totally agree. And I had a similar kind of situation with my two children, because my daughter, the older one, is kind of like the perfect student. I mean, she lives
firstborn female
to learn. Right. She lives to learn, and she enjoys it, and she absorbs everything like a sponge, and reading is you know, just a breeze for her. Whereas with my son, he's more of I thought as a child, when he was a baby, I thought he was actually smarter than she was. But he thought that he was dumb, because when he got into preschool and those sorts of things, he didn't fit the learning mold that everybody expected people to go into.
Kindred spirits here, Anne.
Well, I remember a terrible time with him where I was standing in our summer home that we had. We had a Jack and Jill bath between the two bedrooms, and I was in the middle, in the area where the tub was, and he was actually talking to me, and he was like a 16 or so, 17. He was doing that time in high school when you decide what you're going to do, if you're going to go to college or whatever.
Yes.
He was pounding his head against the wall of the shower, because he was saying, "I am dumb.
Oh, no.
And I was saying, you know, "You are not dumb." But what it is he's a photographer. He's a visual person. He's not a person who learns by reading. You know,
It's
the whole thing that allowed him to bloom was the opportunity for him to find out that there's people that are now recognizing that people learn in different ways. So.
And I think that coming back, what saddens me with the work that I do and with midlife women is that sometimes people get really stuck in that they go on, they marry, they have jobs, they do this and that, but inside of them is still kind of that adolescent that's saying, "I can't do this. Well, I can't do that. I can't risk this. I can't, or I'll be embarrassed, or I'm dumb." And that is such a roadblock. And I think it, you know, for, again, with women, I just see that, well, you know I was supposed to get married and raise kids and do this and that, but beyond that, well, I've never even thought of it. You go, oh, there's a whole world out there.
Right. Well, I'm curious if you could take some time here to talk a little bit about how you went from the counseling psychology and working as a therapist, which to me is a structured type of an environment, and then you moved into coaching. Now, I've done work as a coach, and although I have not been certified as a coach, but I have been hired by people to coach them, and I think that it's fascinating what you can do helping people as a coach, but I'm curious if you would talk about the processes, how they might be different from mm-hmm. the counseling to the life coach. And let's talk a little bit about working with women that are making those changes in their lives. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about giving us an understanding of what's how a coaching process differs from the therapy?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think a little background, because I was trained as a sort of traditional therapist, and I did that for many, many, many years. But one of the things I started to notice, my career has gone through transitions, and I was I was in private practice for 10 years before I had kids, and I worked primarily with children. Uh-huh. And with parents. And then when I became a parent, it was like, oh, I only have so much energy for kids, and you know what? I want to save it for the babies who are at home. Mm-hmm. So I transitioned out and then focused on working with parents. So I think I've gone through my own little evolution over the last 30 years, and after about 20 years of therapy, of doing therapy, that's when I started thinking about coaching. To me, sort of the basic differences, therapy is really about looking backwards. The focus mm-hmm. is primarily on understanding where you came from, what incidences impacted your life or set you going down a certain path. It really is more on your past, and I think mm-hmm. of coaching as on your future. What's mm-hmm. ahead of you? Now, when I start with a new client, I have a couple of requirements, and one is that they have had counseling, frankly. Because okay. I really want to, I work in a community where people know me, and I feel like for the kind of work I have done and where I am at this point in my career, I prefer working with people who really understand their inner workings. But really, in a coaching relationship, I see it as very practical and proactive, and I can just kind of walk you through what I would do with a typical client. Initially, I do a brief history because it's kind of important. It's crucial, in fact, to mm-hmm. understand what makes you tick. You know, what are your buttons?
Right.
What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? Well, I don't like weaknesses, but what are the things that really make you tick?
Mm-hmm.
And then we work on identifying specific goals. You know, maybe it's I want to go back to school, or I want to be brave enough to take a trip by myself to Hawaii, or what. We really identify the specific goals. And then we concentrate on what skills and resources are needed to succeed. What really is involved if you were going to go back to school and get your degree, you know, in music, the mm-hmm. practicality of it, whether that's financial or are your kids raised? Are you going to need daycare? We're really looking at, the nuts and bolts of making the change.
Right.
And this is kind of the fun part, is we devise a game plan. And we come up with the real step by step by step, not grandiose, you know, I'm going to find a cure for cancer. Well, maybe mm-hmm. not. You might have to be a doctor first.
Right.
But really break it down into small, manageable pieces. And I always send people out of my office with homework. I say, okay, I want you to do this by next week or 2 weeks or whenever they're going to come back. Because it keeps people working. You know, you can go to see a coach mm-hmm. or talk to a coach for an hour on the phone, but then you hang up the phone, and then you can just sit down and turn on the TV and not do anything. So
right.
I like to give people homework and say, yeah, let's keep you moving. And then the way I approach it, we do set up, I see a person once a week for a couple of weeks, or maybe I have people now that we just pop in on the phone once a month and they tell me how they're doing. So it really does, it's subtle, it's related to therapy, but as I said, the basic difference is it's about moving forward, and it's very practical and very proactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at this point in my career, I'm 62 years old, you know, and I'm having fun. I don't see myself. It's interesting. My husband's retired. I don't think I don't feel like I'm retiring anytime soon. I'm really having a good time. And so this model is personally quite satisfying for me, because what happens is I seem to be attracting people who are enough like me in terms of they're ready to go. They've got the energy. Mm-hmm. They're motivated. They want to get moving, and so I just kind
right.
of get to go along for the ride and say, hey, have you tried this, or wow, I found this book, read this, or so it's this really kind mm-hmm. of collaborative process that I find very exciting and very satisfying.
Excellent. Well, that's when I was doing coaching, those would be the best kind of coaching clients to have, the ones that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I had a few of them that hired me that I couldn't get them to do the work. So it seemed like, okay, so here we are back another week, and you haven't made any progress since last week.
I know. Well, and then it's, you know, and whenever I take on a new client, I say, now, if we get to knowing each other and I feel like we stumble onto something, I just want, you know, I will refer them. They need to understand that if there's something that comes up or comes out that they may in fact get referred to a therapist. It honestly has never happened. I think my screening process is pretty thorough. But it is frustrating when you go, okay, you know, you're saying all the right things, you're doing this and that,
right,
but nothing's happening. What's going on? So in that regard, I appreciate that I do have a therapy background, because we can kind of take a time out, or, you know, I call it making a left turn. Well, we're going to stop here and try to understand what is behind the resistance, or why are you struggling so much?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are those people who just really aren't going to do it. And I go, well, okay, you're kind of wasting your money. So maybe, you know, call me in 6 months when you're ready. I mean, I'm kind and compassionate, but I also am a realist.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that people should get their money's worth, you know, and how they're going to get their money's worth is to do the work. So,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of a life coach, I think, can help people make so much progress. And I think sometimes, going back to what you were saying earlier, probably what might be holding them up is fear. But then,
mm-hmm.
you know, you would be needing to help them uncover what that fear is that,
yes.
that's causing them to be able to, or not to be able to take any steps. So
yes, well, and I think too, I don't think this is more likely in women versus men, but I do think that that sort of the cultural norm, how you were supposed to be. I mean, I've had so many women say, well, I couldn't do that. I'm, you know, 58, or I couldn't do that. I'm 65. And I go, well, why couldn't you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And there are the shoulds. How are we supposed to behave in midlife? We're supposed to be these, you know, responsible middle-aged women who do X, Y, and Z and not A, B, C, or F, or D. And it's kind of hard to go up against that sometimes and
mm-hmm.
break out of it. So I think a lot of what I do is I really like to practice what I preach. So I'm modeling my philosophy as well as coaching people and helping people really under women, you know, what would happen? You know, let's do doomsday fantasy. I always play this game with clients. You know, what's the worst thing that could happen if you decided to dye your hair red? You know, what
mm-hmm.
really is going to happen?
Right.
Because sometimes we get these stories in our heads going about, oh, my God, you know, I had this one woman, you know, I asked her, I said, can I use this story when I'm teaching because it's a great story? And she always wanted to be a redhead, but she wouldn't do it. And finally I said, what's the worst thing that could happen? And she said, oh, I've got it. I said, what is it? And she said that when she was little, her grandmother, that harlots had red hair.
Ah.
I said,
but what about Lucille Ball?
I said, I said, Carol Burnett and Lucille Ball?
Right.
And she said, well, I know that makes logical sense, but I'm thinking that that somewhere in my mind, a redhead, my grandma didn't approve. And she said, I adored my grandma.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, isn't that, she said, do you think it could be that? And I said, well, it could be, that could be part of it. But that's, you know, that is the advantage of really understanding how we tick, because all those teensy little stories and messages can add up and reinforce the wrong things in us. And I have to tell you, she's a beautiful redhead.
Well, that's great. I'm glad
great.
She overcame her fear of being redheaded.
She did, and you know, it was kind of cute, because I think it gave her permission. She wanted to be more frisky or more relaxed or more casual. She was kind of a button-up professional in her three, you know, her suits, and
mm-hmm.
she just wanted to relax a little. And there was something about changing the color of her hair that gave her that permission. We're all just so different and so unique. So I've always loved that story.
It's a great story. In fact, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about it. Why do you think that we sometimes question ourselves about what we want to do?
I think that it starts when we're little. You know, I think it really, really starts when we're young. And kind of as we were talking earlier, your son and my son, I mean, their experiences that I'm sure no matter how many times you told your son he was smart, or we told our son, your sisters are not smarter than you, they're just different. Mm-hmm. They would go to school, they would have certain experiences, they would be treated, I had your sister last year and she didn't have trouble with this. You know, tiny little statements or experiences that layer upon layer upon layer can erode our confidence or can make us second guess ourselves. I mean, how many times have we heard that phrase, I am my own worst critic?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many of us are always trying to live up to certain standards that were devised again in our childhood or cultural standards. So I think that we have other people's expectations that we worry about. We have other people's standards. I think sometimes it's a lack of just trusting our abilities. Sometimes there's no guarantee with the unknown. There's nobody that you can and probably will fail at different points in your life. And I think that's another message kids get throughout school, is that failure is a bad thing. And in our family, it was, well, what can you learn from it? You put a different spin on it. I think the last thing is really that so often we don't maybe have the proper support system around us. You know, I mean, a friend of mine called her sister and said, you know, I think I'm going to book a tour. I've always wanted to go to, I think it was Norway or something. Or she said, oh my God, you don't want to go there. It's so cold. Why do you want to go there? Why don't you go someplace like Spain? Well, you know, it had nothing to do with the sister. It was this woman wanted to go to Norway. And what did she get? She got pushback. It wasn't okay to do that. And again, in and of itself, it seems really small, a small example. But it left that woman questioning herself. Well, maybe I should go to Spain. You know, I'm spending all this money.
Right.
Maybe I should go where it's warm. And suddenly she's second-guessing herself simply because her big sister, who's, 58, said, oh, why do you want to go there? I wouldn't want to go there. I said, well,
right.
I said, well, you're not taking your sister, right? This is your trip, right? So we're complicated critters. We can really come up with all kinds of ways to get, deer in the headlights.
All right. So with that point observed, what do you think are the major stumbling blocks that we complicated critters experience when we set about to make life changes?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's ourselves. It's that we have that voice, and every one of us has got that chatter, that little voice in there that surfaces at different times. I believe we are our own worst critics, and that we are the ones who, by and large, stop ourselves. I often work with women and people that come in and they, oh, well, he won't let me do that, he or she. And I say, well, have you asked them? And lo and behold, well, no, that's fine. I don't care. You want to do that? Fine. Go do that. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that little chatter or that tape that's been running in the individual's head, that, again, we all write our stories about, oh, that would make him mad, or that will make her upset, or she will disapprove of me. So number one is we are our biggest stumbling blocks. I think that secondarily would be perhaps other people. You know, we don't want to let people down. We don't want to disappoint people. I think so often when I see people on the brink of change, they are very concerned about what's my family going to think. You know, I've never done anything like this before, and we want approval. I think it's human nature. We want approval. We want people to like us, especially those we care about. So it's looking at, I often work with people that we look at sort of these circles. There's your intimates, whether that's a partner or kids or the up close and personal folks. And then there's the next layer of maybe your work world or your social world and their people. And quite often people will they'll labor under the, I just couldn't do that because so-and-so will think this of me. Or they'll really disapprove. You know, I think of a woman who wanted to buy her husband Super Bowl tickets, and I said, well, that's a great gift. Yeah, it was. You know, he'd always wanted to go to the Super Bowl. It was kind of a bucket list for him. And she said, oh, but his mom's going to be so mad. And I said, how old are you? Come on, here. Let's talk about this a bit. And come to find out, mother-in-law, who was like 80-something, is very frugal and is very judgmental. Everybody in the family tree knows that grandma's a penny pincher. And I said, well, so what's worse, that your mother-in-law is upset that you spend the money, or that you and your husband have the experience of a lifetime, or deny yourself the experience of a lifetime? So there we have it again, you know, judgment from other people. So I think those are some of the, you know, major stumbling blocks. And then you kind of get down to the reality of resources. I mean, literally, do you have you may not have the money for what you want to be able to do, or if you want to go live in a foreign country, do you speak the language, or maybe you should learn before you go? I mean, there's mm-hmm. sort of the practical side. Do you have the proper skills? If not, how do you get them? And finances, obviously, are a huge hurdle for a lot of people. But I have fun working with people trying to figure out, let's figure out how we can make this work. You know, maybe you mm-hmm. have to pare back a little bit, and maybe you have to save all year for a trip you wanted to take in 3 months. There are lots of ways to work around some of the financial issues. It's about brainstorming and creativity.
Oh, it really is. And I love the fact that one of our associates right now, our one of our newer associates, is a woman who writes about traveling outside of the country. Mm-hmm. But what she's a retired teacher, and what she's figured out is that she can go and do house sitting. So
yes.
She doesn't have to really, you know, pay that much to go, because people hire her to come in. They're expats. A lot of them are expats who
right.
hire her.
Oh, that's
so they
want
to come back to the United States or something like that. So mm-hmm. she goes and stays in their home for 6 months or 2 months or whatever, and
isn't
that
great?
Gives her a chance to so she's figured out a way to satisfy her wanderlust without having mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. spend that much money. So I really love the fact that when you really sit down and look at what's keeping you from doing something that you really want to do, there usually are creative ways that you can come up with mm-hmm. to overcome the stumbling blocks.
Yeah, well, and I have a great story. I teach a class called What's on Your Bucket List, and I love teaching it, because it's really all about this transition and change. And this woman said, the Pyrenees. There's a hiking trail through the Pyrenees of Spain. Actually, my youngest daughter did it. And she said, I want to go, but I just don't think I'm physically up for it. And another woman raised her hand, and she said, I have MS, and I did that trail. She said, I didn't do it fast. She said, I didn't mm-hmm. do all of it. I figured out I could only walk about an hour, so it took, you know, but she said, I did that trail, and she said, you can do it too. It was just this great moment of, we stop ourselves. It's that same mm-hmm. thing about, if you see yourself as unable to do something, what's getting in the way? And that one has a happy ending. She sent me a postcard. 6 months later, she was on the trail, and she sent me a postcard from Spain. It was just wonderful.
Oh, wonderful. That is fabulous.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Must really make you feel good that the discussion helped her so much mm-hmm. that she was able to get over that stumbling block.
Yeah. Well, I love my job. I feel really grateful for my job. It's really satisfying.
Well, I think that's even better to know that you love your job. But I'm curious, do you see that there's, and this isn't what I was planning to ask you, but do you see that there's more novels in your future, or did you just do one and now it's off the bucket list and you're onto something else?
Well, that's a great question, because both my agent and my publicist have said, when's the sequel coming? And honestly, I've kind of toyed around with that. I've got some ideas for that. But really, what I want to be doing next is I've sort of sketched out a four-book series for children. Mm-hmm. And getting back to your introduction, and it's about Bella Von Doodle, Queen of the Good Dogs. So I've always been equally intrigued by children's books. I guess that's because I started out as a teacher, I'm kind of on the fence here. I'm really mm-hmm. on the fence which direction I'm going to go, because I would like to follow up with some of the characters in Duck Pond. I've got mm-hmm. some ideas of things, but I haven't really mapped that out yet. So it's a very legitimate question.
All right. Well, that's a little segue away from the questions that we were discussing. So getting back to that, before that we were talking about stumbling blocks to making life changes. Mm-hmm. And let's take that a little bit further. Can you give us some tips on what we should be doing in order to help us make these life changes?
Okay,
sure.
I'd start with asking people to do a little personal inventory. You know, what's working in my life really well? And what's not working so well, you know, to really get this baseline understanding of, okay, because out of that you get your strengths. You can say, okay, I'm really good at this. This over here is not, you know, maybe it's not even a weakness. It's just, you know, it's just not interesting. I mean, I'm a terrible mm-hmm. bookkeeper. Don't ask me to balance a check. I do it, but I hate it.
mm-hmm.
So first of all, take that inventory. What's working, what isn't? And then I really encourage people to brainstorm, dream big, without any editing. That's the hard part.
Okay.
Oh, you know, but mm-hmm. we're back to some of those messages. I can't do this. I shouldn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
Get those, just quiet all that chatter. Sit down one day. And some people call it a vision board. They tear things out of
mm-hmm.
magazines. Or some people just sit down and write about it. But dream big and have fun with it. And then if you're still not moving, one of the little exercises I encourage people to do is look at their lives from this perspective. So you look at your physical, emotional, mental, social, and spiritual selves, each part of each of those areas of your life, and are your needs getting met? You know, are you happy with your physical self? Is there something you need to be doing mentally that would be more challenging, more satisfying? Because sometimes if you give yourself this little exercise, again, things bubble to the surface. And you're able to go, oh, wow, I really would like to be doing a dance class. I haven't danced
mm-hmm.
in 30 years, so I'm going to go. Because it's a way to create some structure, and I think that helps people generate some ideas. And then making a change, I would come up with an action plan, because there's something about the process of actually writing it down step by step by step. Start with mini goals, you know, very doable goals. You know,
mm-hmm.
by next week, I'm going to look at 10 websites on cake decorating, because maybe I want to be decorating cakes for a living. Well, let's just start looking at cakes and see if it appeals to you. So little goals initially. Then kind of identify what resources you need. Again, is that a skill set? Is that going to be, are you going to have to float a loan? Are you willing to go into your bank account? Is there a little money there to spend? Resources are very important. And then finally, get support. My personal belief is we are herd animals. we
okay.
do better with support. And that might just be a trusted friend or spouse or partner. That might be a group of women. I love doing book groups these days. And generally, I find they're the most supportive bunch of women. It's like this added bonus to coming to book groups. Everybody knows and supports each other. Because it really is easier if you can share the process a little bit with somebody else. Not that you have to check in every week and report in, but just say, you know, you get together for coffee once a week and say, wow, you know, I can't believe I did this, but, and then share it. Because what your friend is going to do is hopefully cheer you on. And if she doesn't, pick a different friend.
mm-hmm. All right.
If she comes back with, no, I think you should go to Spain, you need to get a different friend to be part of your support team.
All right.
Yeah. So I think those are the steps.
All right. Anything beyond that? If those don't work, what would be the next step?
Well, first of all, recognize that it's not unusual to get stuck. I think that
mm-hmm.
That's, again, human nature. We all get stuck. So it's to the contrary, quite common. I think if you are stuck, I'm always asking people here in California, we have a lot of pretty woo-woo out there people, but truly, if you're stuck, number one, show yourself some compassion. Recognize that change is hard, and be kind to yourself in the way that you would be kind to a friend or someone you loved who was trying to make things happen. You wouldn't be critical of someone else in the way that you're critical of yourself. So kind of simmer down and say, okay, this is hard. It's all right that it's hard. I'm just going to take another step slowly. Patience, where we've become an instant gratification culture. We want change and we want it, you know, now. So
mm-hmm.
have a little patience. I think it's important to really sit down and identify the roadblocks. What is getting in the way? And I like it when people journal. I think that it, not that it had, you know, don't edit, don't correct your spelling. Just go, why am I stuck? Really ask yourself that question. And the roadblocks will surface. Then take the problem to kind of, again, back to some friends. And I mean, I've advised people to invite a few girlfriends over, you know, have a bottle of wine, there's some pizza, whatever you want to do, but approach it as a team. Say, okay, I really want to do X, and I'm not getting there. What do you think? Give me some ideas. And this is the beauty of a team approach. You know, it's a team approach can be one of the best things we can do for ourselves. And then finally, if you really are truly stuck, that's when I say call a coach or call a counselor, because it is sometimes really, really hard to find our way through some of the layers that we're complicated species. And sometimes it, the best thing to do is to go seek out a professional once or twice or more and say, yeah, I've gotten this far, but I want to work with somebody to take me the whole way, you know.
Mm-hmm. So that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful information, Tracy. I'm looking at my clock here, and I'm wanting to keep my promise to people about open up the call to see if any of our listeners have a question. So I have made the call interactive now. Anybody who's listening who would like to ask Tracy a question, all you need to do is speak up, and we'll hear you, and we'll answer your question. Who's got a question?
Well, okay. Shy or...
Yes, sometimes they're shy.
I can understand that.
Yes. Well, I've got some other questions here that we'll go forward with and see if we can, if anybody who's being shy, you know, wants to gather up their courage, we can talk about these other things.
And we have been talking about taking a risk, so I would encourage someone.
Right. Well, I was looking at your website. It's a fascinating website, and I encourage anybody listening to the call to go to it. And, of course, it is called thesecondhalfonline.com, and that's all spelled out. On the website, I saw that you also co-wrote, starred in, and co-produced a one-act musical, which I think is just fabulous because I've always had this little secret dream that I'd like to dance on stage, except for, you know, I am not in the position to do that right now. But so your musical is The Second Half, A Lively Look at Life After 50. And I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about the show.
Well, it was kind of one of my bucket list things, but I have been in community theater. I started singing at 40 when I thought I could never sing. I could never sing. You know, I started singing with the women's ensemble. In fact, later tonight I'm going to rehearsal. But and then kind of got on stage in community productions. But at my age and my skill level, and I'm 6 feet tall, I mean, I didn't – they were not going to be casting me as an ingenue anytime soon. Mm-hmm. So I just had this idea that it would be really fun to write my own one act. And I've always – my kids, they roll their eyes. I've always sort of written new lyrics to melodies. That's just been a fun thing that I do, kind of driving in the car to school. And then I really thought that because of my column and my website, the topic was fraught with good material. I mean, there's nothing like the aging process. So I did join forces with a very good friend of mine who's actually a trained director and has done a lot of official work. And between the two of us, we wrote this one act. And, we have songs about gravity. We have songs about the empty nest and the sandwich generation. We really just looked at all the different phases of life. And I was really inspired by my column, my readers, and my blog. And lo and behold, we produced it locally. And by golly, people really liked it. And I tell you, it was so gratifying. I think that's the writer in me. You write a line, you write the script, and it's kind of like the novel. It's one of the things that's just so wonderful is to be up there on that stage and deliver a line and have a theater erupt in laughter or deliver another line, and there's that kind of collective, that moment of recognition. So it was very successful, and then we were asked by the local Ollie. If people are familiar with the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, which is a national program that does for lifelong learners, people over 50. Mm-hmm. So we've done that now as a fundraiser for them a couple times. And we are, again, you know, it's kind of like we're a whole room full of people, the majority of whom are over 50. So it's a pretty fun evening. We've had a really good time with that. Some talk about taking it on the road. I don't know.
Well,
but
why
I encourage
not?
You. Why don't you? You want to put that? You're going to do that for yourself?
Well, I have been on stage and enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told I'm a terrible singer, so I'm not sure if I could do the singing part. You know, my kids used to listen to me sing, but other people, I mean, when I was a mother of babies, you know, they loved hearing me sing. But other people have said, you know, that's not my strong point. So, but I think that it could happen in the next 10 years. I'd have to work up to it.
Well,
but it does
There's in our community, there's a tap dance class for women over 50, and I'm thinking of joining that because I always wanted a tap dance. I thought that would be so much fun.
Oh, it would be.
Yeah.
So definitely it sounds like you practice what you preach. You identify a risk or a desire, and then you take it. So is this easy for you?
No, not always. Sometimes, but no. I think as a younger woman or as a kid, as a younger woman, I think I was really motivated more by fear or that I kind of had to prove something. I think that was more a reflection. I just didn't think I had a whole lot to offer the world, so I better go out and do something big so people think it, you know. And fortunately, I outgrew that. For most of my adult life, it's like that the anxiety, I mean, standing in the wings, I remember the first night we did the show, because I, you know, the community I'm in, I'm fortunate and then I'm a respected professional in the community, and I had to do that. What's the worst thing that could happen? And I thought, well, I could be the laughing stock of the county. And I thought, well, would that kill me? No, it wouldn't kill me.
Right.
So I've just learned how to recognize that the anxiety is a normal part of it, of the anxiety of putting my book out there for the first time and knowing that not everybody's going to, oh, it's been interesting. Some women love the ending and some women hate the ending, and they'll send me these emails about, why did you do that at the end? And she should have done this, this, and this. And I think maybe if I'd been as a younger woman, that would have really pained me that to have such a critical response. And now I just realize, I mean, that's kind of the fun of writing a book is, you know, everybody's going to react to it differently. And fortunately, the ones who like it are outnumbering the ones who don't. But I think that when I embark on a change, I know that there are just going to be moments when it feels uncomfortable and awkward. And I guess at this point in my life, one of the things I figured out is just sit tight, keep breathing, and work your way through it. Because we're all going to feel that to some extent. It is the nature of taking risk. You will never find me jumping out of an airplane, however.
It's interesting that you would say that, because I asked my husband about that yesterday. I said, you know, I've always had this secret desire that I would like to jump out of an airplane, but after what I've seen lately on the news,
I don't think I could do that.
Right.
My stepmother did. I always admired her. It was something she always wanted to do. That, you know, that holds no interest for me, none whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And yet our youngest daughter's a pilot. She got her pilot's license. And so, again, we're all different. We're just all different. Mm-hmm. But I can't tell you how many people I've met who said I could never get up on stage and sing and dance and act, you know. And honestly, when I was 40, I didn't see that about myself either, which I think is one of the best parts about aging is we are so capable of doing things. Aging, for me, it has given me a certain permission and just kind of like, if I don't do it now, when am I going to get around to it? So so now is the time for me.
All right. And how do you discuss this with your adult children?
Well, I think they just grew up seeing my husband, seeing their mom kind of, for example, they learn by example. My husband was in the newspaper business, and at 38, it was his 38th birthday, and we were decorating his cake. I think we had a kindergartner, and we had three very young kids, and he got laid off from his job. Absolutely. I mean, they offered him a job that he'd had 20 years before, or they'd lay him off.
Oh,
and
how terrible.
It was
having two children in the journalism field, I can totally empathize with that.
And but that night, you know, we had a little birthday party, put the kids to bed, and I told him, I said, when I met you on your first date, you said if you'd had your way to do over, you'd be a teacher. I said, well, now's the time. Because he had pretty much given me the opportunity. I wanted to be home with our kids, and I was a lot when they were little. I wasn't working very much when they were little. I said, you've given this to me, now it's your turn. So I went to work full-time, and he became Mr. Mom and went to college for 3 years and became a teacher. A wonderful second career. He loved it. He was good at it. And I think our kids, you know, they would see us doing things like that. And they may have been 5 and 6 and 4 or something, but they will say, well, you and Dad would just do things. So a lot of it was, part of it was I can remember saying, I'm really nervous about this, but I'm going to do it anyhow, you know. And I can hear them saying that now. I'm really nervous, but I'm going to, you know, like when our daughter wanted to learn how to fly a plane, she said, I think I might be a little nervous, but I really want to know how to do this.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it's a combination of modeling for our kids or now grandkids, and also just that verbal, that belief in children, that belief in grandchildren, in each other, just that. I find that so much of the work I do is simply believing in that human being and saying, yeah, you can do this, you know. I know you can do this, and let's figure out how. So so now we fast forward on our kids, and I think they got the message because each one of them has definitely followed his or her own path. And they do things, I just can't believe what they do sometimes.
Isn't that wonderful? Makes you feel like you did a good job.
Yeah. Couldn't be happier in that department. So.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful talking to you about this, and thank you for being my guest and for this great discussion. Is there anything that you'd like to say before we wrap up the call? Is there anything I didn't discuss or...
Well, you know, I had a thought real quickly because I love that we live in an electronic age these days. And like I said, I'm doing book groups via electronics, which is really fun. If someone has a book group they'd like me to join via, we can do it as a Google Hangout or on Skype or on just a conference call. But also I'd like to offer your readers a free 20-minute consultation based on this call if they'd really like to kick some things around. If they will just email me. With NABBW in the subject line, and then send me an email at tracy@thesecondhalfonline.com. And I'm happy to set up a little 20-minute chit-chat, and we can kind of see what direction people are going, because I think that sometimes we just get stuck in our own stuff, and sometimes it's really fun to just kick it around a bit. So that's the only other thing I would add, except my appreciation for the opportunity, Anne.
Well, it's been wonderful having you as a guest here this evening, Tracy, and that's a wonderful offer that you've made, and I hope people will